Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. After a meteoric rise, China today is one of the world's most powerful nations. Just a century ago, it was a crumbling empire with literacy reserved for the elite few. As the world underwent a massive technological transformation that threatened to leave them behind. Ching Su, a Yale professor and world-renowned authority on East Asian languages, tells us about her new book, Kingdom of Characters, The Language Revolution That Made China Modern. Ching Su joins us this morning to tell us about the book, Kingdom of Characters, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ching to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for having me.
It's a wonderful pleasure to have you on the program. You are the John M. Schiff Professor of East Asian Languages and the Comparative Literature Chair of the Council on East Asian Studies at Yale, specializing in modern Chinese literature and culture from the 19th century to the present. So, with that title, how does a book like this ultimately come into your radar?
Well, I wanted to do three things with this book. One, I wanted to write a book about how China came to be the global power that it is today. Two, I wanted to show how the driving force behind this process is actually the modernization of its language, China's first and last Great Wall. And finally, I want to tell the story through the lens of, you know, not just policies and governments, but individuals, you know, like, these, what I call second and third stringers of history who made it happen, geniuses, hacks, innovators, and adventurers from both China and outside of China.
So when you take on something as large as this, I mean, I'm right in assuming, I'm giving you much credit here, that this is a huge project.
I mean, yes, it has been, as my editor can tell you, too.
Yeah, it's a huge project. So like any huge project, how do you decide, okay, this is where we're going to have to start this? This is where the story will begin.
And you're absolutely right, because the first task was, how do I scale this down so it's manageable in like a 200-300-page book?
Right.
Because the story, the history of this really began 400 years ago. So this idea, so this process of the Chinese script revolution, the longest revolution of the 20th century that few people know about, has been really going on for 400 years, culminating in the 20th, which is what I decided to focus on. And another thing that helped me narrow it down was actually I decided that behind each of these written characters has to be a human story. So it's all about the human innovators, the individuals who at every stage sort of catapulted and pushed it forward to the next.
You make the point in the book that we don't often really take a good glimpse into how languages are made. So as you take us through China's language revolution, you look at this connection between language and power in great detail. Give us a sense of that relationship and ultimately what that should mean to us.
Well, actually, we can start by just, you ever look at a Chinese character, it looks kind of square, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So even that form took some time to evolve. That the earliest evidence we have of Chinese writing is actually the ones we discovered about 3,000 years old, singed onto ox bones and turtle shells. These are the earliest language, the earliest evidence we have, and they're from oracle bones. So these are, of course, simple characters. They're kind of long, oblong, sometimes rectangular, and sometimes just sort of sticks out in odd places. So it took a unification process in the third century for Chinese to kind of settle into the form that we know today. But, you know, the origin of Chinese language really has this very powerful myth and a philosophical origin behind it. The story goes that a four-eyed sage was looking up at the cloud formations in the sky and looking down at the tracks left in nature by animals like birds or, you know, the patterns that you see in leaves and stems of plants. And he realized that there's a pattern in the universe, in the cosmos. And so he invented writing, at least the myth goes, to correspond and be part of those patterns that govern the cosmos. And so this idea of Chinese having a great weight, this great authority, right, sort of persisted throughout the centuries. In the 20th, however, it took on a very different dimension. 20th century is the era of nations, right? Nationalism. And Chinese language came under the pressure of how to modernize and westernize and to harness its power in the global age by standardizing and modernizing its script for technological use.
So in doing that, when you figure this out, what were the challenges that China faced to ensure the growth of their language, that it remained dominant?
That is exactly the story of the book, where, you know, the problem was, you know, by all counts, evolutionarily speaking, as linguists would tell you, all languages tend towards simplification. That's not really the case with Chinese. I mean, if you look at it today, the character writing is still pretty much what it looked like a century ago. Sure, there's some simplification process in the 1950s and the communist era that took out strokes from a number of characters, like, you know, thinning out an underbrush. But still, the character is square. It is not alphabetic. And has retained this form remarkably consistently throughout the 20th century, despite all the reforms. So the trick was what was done behind the scenes, right, kind of under the hood. Like, what did the Chinese have to do to break through the bottlenecks of telegraphy, right? How to send Chinese in telegraph, how to type Chinese on a typewriter, how to fit all those characters onto a keyboard, right. And then finally, how to enter into the computing age.
And when you look at that, what were the main challenges? I mean, because there were continued challenges. In reading the book, I mean, this was an ongoing story, series of challenges.
Right. And the first was the number, the size of the Chinese character inventory, right? We have 80,000 characters. Now, admittedly, a number of those are not used. But to achieve average literacy, like reading newspapers and get along your everyday business, you need about 3,000 to 4,000. So compare that to the size of the Western alphabet. Now, one of the unique things about the Western alphabet and what makes it so powerful is that there's only 26 letters that you have to learn. And after you learn that, you can basically compose and pronounce any word, right? Build from those like Lego blocks. Now, for Chinese, it's different. So the idea is, how do you trim down size? And then how do you deal with the complexity of its structure? Now, traditionally, Chinese wasn't broken down into parts. There was one particular, it's kind of like an ID tag that we use to, you know, classify Chinese characters called radical, but that's only one part of a character. The rest of it, kind of for a very long time, prior to the 20th century, were kind of treated as a whole. So, for instance, the question with typewriters was, well, what are you supposed to do? If you look at your keyboard, you know, it's like a classic QWERTY keyboard, right? There's keys of 26 letters, but are you supposed to fit thousands of characters on there? And in fact, the first Chinese typewriter that was invented in the late 1890s, not by Chinese, interestingly enough, but by an American Presbyterian missionary, Novello Zelotto's Sheffield. He designed the first Chinese language typewriter, and it looked like nothing you would imagine a typewriter look today. It's like a flat drum disc, and it could spin around. And he would use it to sort of move these mechanisms of, you know, pen and ink, inking mechanism and levers and pulls to make a line up before you can print a single character. So the first attempt was this kind of, you know, pretty literal interpretation of the keyboard, which is, okay, I got to fit one key per character, mm-hmm. So I need thousands of keys. But the true innovation of the 20th century was that the Chinese figured out how to look at their language differently, how to conceptualize it in a way that goes against what it had been for millennia. And that is to say, how to break down characters into parts or components. So it's kind of like the way you use letters to compose a word. With Chinese, the components range about, you know, 3 to 4 per character. And so if you were to type on a typewriting keyboard, that means it only takes 3 to 4 keystrokes to complete the Chinese character. Whereas if you type an English word, the average English word is closer to 5, right? So it takes 5 or more strokes to type out English.
You were just talking about the missionary and that part of the story, but you weave in these stories of these figures who made contributions, and often they're overlooked and are not part of the scholarship. So give us a sense of unearthing that work and taking a look at these characters and researching their stories. What goes into that?
So one of the things I really enjoy writing about this book is that I basically live in the minds of these people who are, you know, they're not your big revolutionaries or war heroes or martyrs that you hear about and write about in history books. These are what I called the second and third stringers of history, who had to pick up the pieces after the glory of revolution, the bloodshed from wars, the tumult between government changes, of which there were many in 20th century China, and roll up their sleeves and ask, how do we move our country forward? So among them, some of my favorite characters, the opening chapter features a wanted fugitive, right? He was wanted in the last dynasty for trying to overthrow the last dynasty. And he had escaped and escaped to Japan, where he could have very well lived out the rest of his existence in peace. But he had this burning desire and the determination, the ambition to bring back to China a whole new way of phoneticizing its cumbersome script. And so he snuck across the border in 1900 and came back to do this. Now, Wang Zhao, which is his name, was very important, and he was the first of many of these incredible, I call them the foot soldiers of the Chinese script revolution. There was also the engineer and bamboo expert, a young engineer who ended up going to MIT in the 1910, who developed and brought back a Chinese typewriter. There was also a railway administrator who tried to send telegrams in a language without an alphabet. And my favorite is really chapter 4, a grumpy but stylish librarian who saved the day during the war against the Japanese by transporting 300,000 books across war zones just to get them to safety so that he could preserve the Chinese cultural heritage.
That chapter is titled The Librarian's Card Catalog. That's 1938. So in the grand scheme of things, that's recent history, isn't it?
It really is recent history. It's actually astonishing. Like I mentioned earlier that the Chinese script revolution, the modernization process, took 400 years, more than 400 years to kind of reach to this point. But the majority, the main action really happened in the 20th, right? So, you know, the grumpy librarian was 30s and 40s. But then even through wars, even through the devastating decade of the Cultural Revolution, I write the story of a prison inmate. He was wrongly imprisoned, who inscribed the first computer input codes for Chinese on the lid of a teacup, right? So there are many of these tenacious people who just astonished me as I actually, that's one of the most, I think the most joyous experience of working on this project. And in between the long hours of trying to write is how inhabiting their minds and their lives was truly an eye-opening experience. Because these, you know, despite what was happening around them, they decided that there was a cause greater than themselves.
When you take on something like this, and as I said, you know, some of this just being recent history, at what point do I assume you're regularly surprising yourself as to what you find?
That is the joy, I think, of both rummaging around in the archives, which I did across actually 3-4 different continents for this project, and I think being a historian or a scholar, and where you teach and you're constantly discovering new things. And it is true. You're constantly, the one thing about this is that your curiosity is constantly renewed by this extraordinary history of China, which remains, you know, remains to be excavated still.
When you look at this kingdom of characters, the language revolution that made China modern, talk about that, the making of it modern, of how that ultimately happened and those forces coming together.
When we think about what's required of the modern era, right, when we think about modernity and what it means to us, really, one thing that really comes to mind is technology. Everything is faster, more efficient. I mean, it's unthinkable that we could actually multitask, right, last century. But now you could be sending communication, you could be texting and, you know, and sending files back and forth across different, you know, hemispheres within a blink of an eye. And so for Chinese, the language had to cross that threshold that somehow this archaic, right, this very old writing system had to drag itself across this threshold and into the modern world and make it fit technologically for all this kind of advantage that modern age has to offer.
In writing the story when you wrote it, did you feel that it, as you ended in writing it during the pandemic, that it gives us new lessons that, or maybe reminds us of lessons that are so relevant now and should be shared?
You know, I joke with my publisher that, you know, it took a pandemic for me to finish this book. But of course, I think for everyone out there, I think a pandemic has really been a period of inward turning, a kind of, you know, sitting with ourselves and thinking our thoughts. And even though as a scholar and a teacher, I do that plenty just in everyday life, it was a different moment to be able to be fully immersed in the idea of history and to live through these war-torn periods where, you know, kind of like us, people were isolated, they were separated from their loved ones, and the importance of them to keep this light ahead of them, this light of this Chinese script revolution, to think of themselves as being part of something greater than their current circumstance. I think that was actually kind of a very interesting, unexpected realization that I had while finishing the book.
And that we can end with peace. That is possible.
I think that is, and thank you for bringing that up. I think that really is my message in this book. You know, at a time where the world is embroiled in the pandemic, where there's a lot of geopolitical tensions, and we're worried about our future, we're worried about the next generation. There's so many things to be concerned about. But I do want to bring back some hope and to point out that, you know, China and the U.S. have long been learning from each other way before they became foes. And I think that's actually a kind of a hopeful message of the book, because modern China is not just China under Mao. It's not just the CCP. It's not just Communist China. But there are these longer trajectories where we can show how it was not that different. One of the purposes of writing these books from the perspective of individuals is I wanted to really put ourselves in the heads of these individuals, their dreams, their aspirations. You know, it's pretty human. It's not so different from probably what we would have done in their place. And so that's what I hope to do.
I think that's a great point of making it human and showing that humanity, which helps and can help many of us better understand China's past and present and, yes, even its future.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that really is the one thing that came out, you know, when I finished it, is that, you know, the pandemic is a time where I think more than ever, we need to be reminded of the collective, of the things that we share as a humanity, not just as rivaling nations.
The name of the book is Kingdom of Characters, The Language Revolution That Made China Modern. The publisher of the book is Riverhead Books. Jing Su, I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program, and I wish you all the luck in the world with the book.
Thank you so much, Joe. Take care.
Be well. Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book is Kingdom of Characters, The Language Revolution That Made China Modern by Jing Su. It is published by Riverhead Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.